This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
This is the BBC.
Welcome to the briefing room with me, David Aronovich. The idea is that you and I enter a virtual room and get briefed together on the important questions of the day by people who know what they're talking about. If you like it, if you don't, or you just have a thought about it, please let us know what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. This week, we're asking, what does the rail timetable fiasco tell us about the future of our railways? And if you enjoyed this podcast, you might want to download other editions of The Briefing Room. Last time, for example, we asked what kind of relationship with the European Union Britain is looking for after Brexit. Meet Lorna Fitzpatrick, who commutes daily from Burnley to Leeds, or this summer has been trying to.
I have this dread every single morning because I know that the train's probably going to be late and I'm probably not going to get to work on time as usual.
Every single aspect of my life revolves around this train and I'm just absolutely sick of it. I'm at the end of my tether. It's had such a massive impact on my life, my professional and my personal life, and I can't be the only one in this situation.
She isn't. Lorna uses Northern Rail, which on Monday reintroduced services which were scrapped after timetable meltdowns in May. Earlier, down south, Govia Thameslink unveiled the third new timetable for its trains in less than 2 months. This is Emily Ketching, Harpenden to London via Purgatory.
What that means for real people in the real world is we won't be able to drop our kids off at school in the morning and still get to our desks in London at the time that we need to be there. Significantly increased journey times, fewer trains. I'm concerned whether we're going to be able to get on trains, let alone get to our desks when we need to be there.
Or back to the children when she's done. The train companies and Network Rail have apologised for the disruption. But this week on The Briefing Room, we'll be asking, why has a new timetable created so much rail havoc this summer, and what does it tell us about the state of rail travel in Britain? First, to give me an expert's take on what's been going on, I'm joined in The Briefing Room by Tony Miles of Modern Railways magazine. He's down the line from Salford. Can you just give us a brief reminder of what the structure of the railway services in the United Kingdom actually is?
What we have in the UK is that the tracks, the infrastructure and the stations are owned by Network Rail, which is a nationalised company now. It was taken back from Railtrack and renationalised. And the train services are provided by operators who are awarded franchises for a period of time to run the services. And generally, in the bidding process to win a franchise, they propose to bring additional capacity by either running more trains or longer trains or newer trains on the tracks that are provided by Network Rail.
So, Tony, looking at the places where there have been problems, well, just tell us where they are, really, and why they've happened.
So the Govia Thameslink franchise covers a large number of services through the centre of London from places such as St Albans and Luton, Cambridge, Peterborough, down through the centre of London onto the Brighton main line and then routes sort of each side of that diverging once they've come through London. And it's the biggest franchised operator in the country at the moment in terms of the number of trains it runs. The government, ahead of awarding the contract, ordered 115 new trains. So the new contract was obliged to use the trains, eventually with 24 trains an hour running through the centre of London. So very, very ambitious. And what actually happened was that the timetable itself was seen as too ambitious. Network Rail, right at the beginning of the process, as the contract was being let by the government, was saying there's an awful lot of trains on this and we're not sure the system can cope. Other companies that shared the route, such as East Midlands Trains to the north of London, were being told you're going to have to change all your timetables to make the trains fit round them. So a lot of reorganisation. And as the time got closer, even into early 2018, bearing in mind it normally takes over a year to prepare timetables, there was still some uncertainty. And the final timetable was agreed on the 4th of May. And this was due to start on Monday, the 21st of May, big time. Essentially, it was seen as overambitious, particularly in the short term, because the railways generally, as is regularly reported, struggle to run trains 100% on time. Govia Thames Link, they're being very honest that as they started to finally get the timetable nailed down and there was so much discussion backwards and forwards, they admitted they didn't have enough drivers to drive the full service and they hadn't completed the driver training programme because, again, things were late being ready for the drivers to start learning the routes. They thought they'd got some contingencies in place, like they would have someone that did know the bits of route to pilot the drivers through the new sections. But again, once trains were late, the people to pilot them were in the wrong place. So it very quickly fell apart.
Right. That's the south. Tell us about the area affected in the north.
In the north of England, we've got two companies involved. Northern Rail provides the local services right across the north of England, from Carlisle to Newcastle, right down to Manchester, Leeds, Sheffield, and across the country. A very large number of services. Linked in with that is TransPennine Express, which operates the fast services between the big cities. So Liverpool, Manchester, York, Newcastle, and up to Scotland as well, from Manchester and eventually Liverpool.
So tell us what happened there.
So in Northern, when the Northern and the TransPennine Express franchises were let and they started in 2016, the Department for Transport issued an invitation to tender in which it listed not only the desire for lots more services, but it promised that the infrastructure in the north of England, particularly in the northwest, would be upgraded, ready for the extra services. So the railway from Manchester through Bolton to Preston and the railway from Preston to Blackpool would be electrified. And there would be additional work to enable more trains to run through Manchester. And as part of this as well, the £85 million Ordsall Cord, which would allow trains to run from Manchester Piccadilly straight through Manchester Victoria for the first time, and then on to the northeast from Manchester Airport. And all of these things were supposed to come together to make the timetable work, but the electrification of the route through Bolton, originally scheduled for completion in December 2016, then became December 2017, then became May 2018, when the timetables were due to start. And at the last minute, with only 4 months to go, Network Rail said, well, it's going to be late December 2018 before it's done. So Northern very quickly had to completely replan how it would use its trains, how it would use its drivers, and try and construct a timetable that takes a year to prepare in about 4 months.
So Northern essentially were given an impossible task, which hadn't been set out to them in that way when they originally bid for the tender.
Yes, they and TransPennine Express as well, which has been equally badly hit, were both expecting work to be done on dates that were written down in the invitation to bid for the contract. It's not like they were hopeful things might be done. There were finished dates in the contracts, and those dates were missed. So electric trains are standing around spare at the moment that should be running on the new route. And the diesel trains that should be providing extra room for passengers on other services are still being used rather than being released.
Now, how has Network Rail explained the situation that it effectively got Northern Rail into?
So Network Rail's public explanation about the delays in completing the infrastructure are partly they had problems with contractors collapsing on the electrification of the route. They've also said that the ground conditions that they found through some of the railway around Bolton, where there are underground mines that have been closed for years, meant that when they tried to dig holes to put the supports for the overhead wires in the ground, they found the ground couldn't cope with the drilling or was about to collapse into the mine.
I'm really sorry. I thought people did surveys to find out that kind of stuff.
This is the interesting thing, that Network Rail are saying it was unknown and unexpected, and they found sand where they thought they'd find rock and things. Other people are saying you can do an internet search or you can look up the history of when the original railway was built and where the mines are, and you can find nearly all the workings.
How do you think we should change things to stop this happening again?
There's some interesting thoughts already coming from the new chief executive of Network Rail, who's starting later this month, Andrew Haynes, who, ahead of slipping into the hot seat, has started to look at the situation across the country. He's identified several companies where he's told them, with advice to the government, that they can't introduce their next timetable changes in December because the railway isn't ready for them. And what we're hearing he's found is that the people on the infrastructure project side of Network Rail haven't been honest enough, quickly enough, where there are problems. It feels like, from what I'm picking up, there's been a nervousness from engineering teams to tell the truth, to be honest, quickly enough, and to bring the bad news when it is bad news. And that's got to change. They've got to feel confident that by being honest, they'll either get additional support or they'll get understanding or whatever if they've encountered problems.
Tony Miles, what do the train operators have to say? Robert Nesbitt speaks for the Rail Delivery Group. It represents the train companies and Network Rail.
We can deliver some good news after what has been, you know, I'm not trying to put any dressing on this, trying to make it better than it was. It was frankly appalling for many customers. And of course, many of us who work in the railways travel by trains every day. We have gone through the same kind of issues as commuters have in both Manchester and in London. And thank goodness there is going to be a reintroduction of a lot of the services that were taken out in the northern area. There are still infrastructure projects that are being worked on at the moment. And of course, we would like to snap our fingers and, you know, and make them right.
But how did the structure come into being that allowed such a situation to develop? And how might it be modified so it doesn't happen again? Earlier, I spoke to Dieter Helm, who's Professor of Economic Policy at Oxford University. He's an expert in regulation and infrastructure, and he was speaking from Oxford. Dieter Helm, other transport doesn't run into difficulties like this. I mean, if, for instance, National Express wants to retimetable its entire coach fleet, then it's no big problem. Why is rail so hard?
Think about a bus company, right? You stand at a bus stop. Does it really matter if it arrives exactly on time? Does it really matter exactly how it parks? Does it really matter how exactly the coach terminals work? And contrast that with standing on your local train platform. It really does matter exactly when that train arrives. That train line has to carry a certain amount of capacity. It matters exactly how the signalling works. It matters exactly how the trains turn around in stations. Coaches are flexible networks where each unit has its own cost. Most of the bus companies don't even own the buses that they have. It's a sort of service with quite a lot of flexibility and variance in it. It don't much matter if the timetable's exact. This, in the railway case, is anathema. And it's exactly because it does matter how the timetable works and how exactly it's coordinated with the rail network that you end up with the fiasco we had with just changing the timetables. I think that the difference between bus companies and proper rail companies is enormous. The only thing they've got in common is that they're in a sector roughly called transport.
Now, I was around at the time of rail privatisation in the early 1990s. Perhaps you could remind me what it was that it was trying to achieve.
There was essentially one underlying assumption, which was that railways were in relative decline to other forms of transport, and no assumption that it was going to be an era of substantive growth in rail transport. The unwritten objective was to get rid of the subsidy, to essentially move gradually towards the fare payers paying more and more of the total costs of the railways and the Treasury contribution getting less and less. And finally, a view that open access competitive market models such as those pursued in electricity would work in the railways. And you put those three things together, squeezing the subsidy, which means pushing up the prices, an assumption about declining volumes, and a very almost ideological view about competition on the railways. And you've got a system which was spectacularly badly designed for the challenges of the railways going forward.
Badly designed, but how did things turn out?
Well, it turned out anything but the original model. So first of all, it turned out that this was a subsidy-hungry industry, which would require subsidies in perpetuity. Secondly, it turned out that open competition wouldn't work, except in very, very exceptional circumstances, and we ended up with franchise monopolies. And thirdly, it turned out that we needed to graft more and more passengers onto the existing lines while the existing franchise operators were trying to screw out as much money from the customers as possible, faced with the need to bid to the Treasury what subsidies they would need and particularly how those would come down. In other words, this is a structure that was never going to work, isn't going to work, and the fact that it may have managed to achieve some things along the way has done nothing to address those underlying problems. And they won't go away. They're there, and they're going to result in more and more of the kinds of problems we've witnessed for what is an incredibly elementary and simple problem, just how to change the timetables. Even that couldn't be managed on our existing system.
Well, to deal with the structural problem that lies behind what you call the elementary problem, wouldn't it make a start for there to be just one person in charge, say, the minister?
It's pretty hard to think how you could make the railways function worse than they currently do. But one possible candidate is to make the Secretary of State in charge of running the railways. That is a lesson we learnt very seriously in the days of nationalisation. That doesn't work. DfT, even in its best moments, and there haven't been a lot of those, is not an obvious candidate to do that.
So, no to the Department for Transport, but if the problems of the present system are as big as you say, and the minister shouldn't do the job, then what is the missing link? We have Network Rail as well as the train company, so maybe that's the body to hold the ring.
It's true that we have Network Rail, but we have National Grid when it comes to electricity. The difference is that we have a system operator in electricity to make sure the various companies and their component parts fit together. We don't have that in railways. What is the authority of Network Rail vis-a-vis a particular franchisee? When something goes wrong, whose fault is it? Is it clear? Who decides whose fault it is? Who overrides and makes the right things happen? This is a disaggregated system, and there's nothing wrong with disaggregation provided the system characteristics themselves are properly taken care of. And in railways, they're not. The system operation is a technical function which requires planning and coordination.
OK, so to put you on the spot, what is the prescription?
We need someone to coordinate the system, but not to actually run it. But what it has to have is authority and power to control the system over and above the interests of the train operating companies and all the component parts. This isn't a partnership between a system operator and all the players. This is a world in which the system operator is in control and then the parties work to that control. And that's the possibility that's opened up by having a system operator, like we do in electricity and like we're evolving towards in the water catchments too. And within that framework, once you've got control and you've got coordination, that seems to me to open up the possibilities for more vertical integration, for trying out bringing track and trains together in particular areas and particular regions, and to bring in a host of other new ideas and new players, including some of the tech companies who bring with it the data and the coordination of that data. So we can have a much more pluralistic model. We can have much more integration. We can have much more experimentation. We can have different versions for urban centres and major cities, but always within the system coordination function and somebody being in charge of those and someone being responsible for them.
Professor Dieter Helm. His notion of a system operator is a role that some, though not Professor Helm himself, might think that the Secretary of State for Transport should fill. But the current preference seems to be very much for hands-off. This was Transport Secretary Chris Grayling talking to MPs on the Commons Transport Select Committee last week.
It would have been irresponsible, in my view, for a Secretary of State who is not a specialist in rail matters to intervene and say this must not go ahead.
He insisted that he was neither responsible for train timetables, nor should he be.
It's the view of the Labour Party that actually the Secretary of State possibly should be responsible for running the railways. But right now, it cannot be the case that if we have a private railway, the Secretary of State has to be accountable for timetables. And that would be a crazy situation.
Of course, Mr. Groening wasn't responding to ideas like Dieter Helm's that someone else entirely might assume overall operational responsibility. What does that kind of notion look like to someone who is both an expert but has also exercised political power? Lord Andrew Adonis was Transport Secretary in Gordon Brown's new Labour government, and then he was head of the current Conservative government's Infrastructure Commission. He joins us in the briefing room in his capacity as someone who's been there and done that and learned the lessons. Andrew Adonis, in your experience, is there a kind of fundamental flaw in the system that allows crises like these to happen?
There is a structure that is very problematic in the case of the rail industry because of the way it was semi-privatised. I say semi-privatised because people claim that it's privatised, but in fact, half of the industry, which is the track infrastructure, is a fully nationalised industry. I mean, the Secretary of State for Transport appoints the chairman and the chief executive of Network Rail, and the state owns Network Rail, so there's no excuses there for anything going wrong. And when it comes to the train companies, they're all franchised, which means contracted in minute detail by the Secretary of State for Transport. I mean, you know, including precisely when trains will run and what the pattern of the timetable will be. So there is a thin controller, or a fat controller. They call me the thin controller, but there is a controller in the system, and it's the Secretary of State for Transport. The issue is whether or not the Department for Transport is good enough at its job, and clearly it needs to improve.
What you're describing is a system which is, though in a different way, every bit as much state-controlled as was British Rail back in the days of yore. It says something else.
It's not every bit as much state control, because under British Rail, the state owned everything, whereas now the state owns the track and it licenses the private companies, you know, led by people like Richard Branson and Brian Suter, to operate the trains. But because they can only operate the trains on a contract with the government, which stipulates precisely what's going to happen, this is a thoroughly state-regulated industry. And what happens, and it's a problem at the moment, is that when something happens and you don't want to take responsibility for it, you claim it's somebody else's fault, and the Department for Transport is very good at that. When something's going well, like the opening of Crossrail that's about to happen, or the refurbishment of St Pancras Station, then somehow this was all to the government's credit. And what we need now is a much clearer sense that the Department for Transport is in fact the linchpin of this whole semi-nationalised industry, and it's where the buck stops, both in the good days and the bad days.
The problem with that is that you've described exactly why the Department of Transport actually is not very good at doing that.
Well, it's not always bad at it. I mean, most of the last 15 years since essentially the collapse of Railtrack, which was the big catastrophe since privatisation. Do you remember when we had a succession of rail accidents and we had 30 mile an hour speed restrictions across the whole network and Railtrack collapsed, and, you know, I was the guy working for Tony Blair who effectively had to renationalise it. There's not even the pretense now that it's anything other than a public company. So the system has worked for most of the time since then. I think most independent observers would accept that it's not doing the job very well at the moment.
But why would a Department of Transport run a rail network, a largely commercial rail network, particularly well?
Well, the job has to be done by somebody, and whichever public body has responsibility recruits the people who can do it. So in the days of British Rail had the rail planners and the people who were expert at timetabling and so on. Now, the Department for Transport has a lot of these people. It recruits them. In my day, you know, we recruited people specifically for their expertise in timetabling and ordering trains. The difference, and I think it's a real problem, and this isn't making a political point, but a policy point, is that when you had British Rail, the person actually responsible for taking the decisions, as it were, the state's viceroy to the rail industry, was the chairman of British Rail. Can I let you into a secret? When I was age 10, it's the job I always wanted to do. I looked at Sir Peter Parker, who was then the chairman of British Rail, and I thought that is the best job in the world, because you are the person who controls the whole system. Now that person, by force of circumstance, is the Secretary of State for Transport. Now, my opinion, when it comes to detailed decisions and operational decisions on the rail timetable and on managing crises that we've got at the moment, the Transport Secretary probably isn't the ideal person to be doing this. The reason we had a chairman of British Rail who did it, who was at one stage removed from the government, is that that meant that the job was less politicised. I think what we need now is, without having another revolution in the whole of this industry, which I think would cost us dear, is to create a post a thin controller, a fat controller, whatever you want to call it, but somebody who is not the Secretary of State for Transport, but who in fact oversees and on behalf of the government, on a commission from the government, takes these detailed decisions about rail management.
Now that seems to fit in with what Dieter Helm was just talking about to us, where he said also that we need someone to coordinate the system, but not to actually run it, was his distinction. And he kind of imagines a system operator, as operates with something like the National Grid. Is that the kind of thing that you're thinking of too?
Yes, I think that is the right way of thinking about it. And actually, I'm not sure it necessarily involves creating a new post, because the chairman of Network Rail, which is the single biggest entity in this organisation, it is the state body that owns all the track. If the chairman of Network Rail was made the system operator, they would become a figure very similar to the chairman of British Rail before we had this very complex system of contracts and all of that. And what I would do is simply invest the chairman of Network Rail with statutory responsibilities to be the system operator on behalf of the Secretary of State for Transport.
But isn't that person always compromised by his or her responsibilities towards the people at Network Rail? It just seems to me, thinking about it completely from the outside, that it might be better to have what you might call an honest broker who actually stands above both Network Rail and the rail franchises.
Well, you can cut this either way, but another big upheaval in the organisation of this industry will take everyone's eye off the ball for between 5 and 10 years, which is how long it takes to conduct these big reviews. And I'm not sure you'd be better off, because though it's true that Network Rail has a stake in the operations at the moment and isn't always an impartial observer, nothing can happen in the rail industry without Network Rail being involved and agreeing, because it owns all the track. I mean, let me let you into a secret. You can't operate any trains unless you've got the track and signalling sorted out, and they're the biggest bottleneck in the whole system. So having a chairman of Network Rail who is briefed, as it were, to be system coordinator for the whole industry, I think could work well and doesn't involve massive structural upheaval. And the big mistake in this game, but I'm afraid it's one that often Whitehall is quite good at, is when things aren't working, they love the idea of a big system upheaval, because that means that they can pass the buck for the next 5 to 10 years and do what they love doing, which is new legislation, creating new organisations, appointing new people. The poor bloody passengers, though, while all this is going on, their service doesn't improve.
One of the things that people that we've been talking about earlier in the programme is also a kind of a strange culture within organisations like Network Rail of just not wanting to fess up to the bad news or when things are going wrong or when there are going to be difficulties, and not planning for those difficulties. It's almost a kind of like you have a sort of gung-ho from the Secretary of State or from the Centre, yes, we're going to kind of do all these fantastic things and you're going to do them really quickly. And then everybody says, oh, yes, yes, well, we absolutely are. And then when it slows down, something goes wrong with which people really need to know about, which needs to be built into the system, nobody will do it.
Well, I think it's a cultural thing. The bit of the national transport system that has worked spectacularly well in the last 50 years, and we should talk about the things that succeed, not just the things that fail, is Transport for London. Few people would deny that the quality of London's transport infrastructure and the reliability of services has been transformed in the last 15 years. I mean, if you go on the Victoria Line or the Jubilee Line, literally the trains, because of new electronic signalling and automatic train operation, they follow each other down the track and the reliability is very strong. Now, that has been run as a public corporation, at one stage removed from the Mayor of London. The Mayor of London appoints the Transport Commissioner for London, who is, as it were, the system operator for London, and he coordinates all of the buses, all of the tubes, a lot of the overground services now. Now, why has that worked so successfully? I think for two reasons. Firstly, because of the office of Mayor of London, and the Mayor is elected, and he knows, or she knows, that they're going to lose an election if London's transport system grinds to a halt. But the culture that they've then instilled in Transport for London has been very traveller focused. The development of the Oyster card, which is world leading, there's no other city of our size that has an integrated ticketing system as efficient as Oyster. That's all come because of a team of really brilliant engineers in Transport for London who've been very, very passenger focused. So it's a cultural thing. Unfortunately, we don't have that culture in Network Rail or the train operating companies or the Department for Transport, and that's a big problem.
That's it for this week. My thanks to Lord Adonis, Dieter Helm and Tony Miles, and my best wishes to Lorna Fitzpatrick and Emily Ketching of Harpenden. We'll be back next Thursday. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich. The editor was Charlotte MacDonald. The producers were Simon Coates, Emma Bishop and Olivia Beasley. Please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider, and we really do enjoy hearing from you.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So, if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.